Let's call this meeting of the House Judiciary Committee to order. It is 1:35 p.m. on Wednesday, February 23rd, 2022. Before we begin, I want to thank Shannon McCain, the House Judiciary Secretary, who makes sure we have a transcript of our meetings, and Kelsey Riker from the Juneau LIO, who makes sure we have sound. At this time, I want to remind committee members and those in the room to please silence your cell phones. Present today, we have Representative Eastman, Representative Christ Tompkins on the telephone, Representative Drummond, my Vice Chair Representative Snyder, and myself, Representative Klayman. We have a quorum to conduct business. I want to note just the, in light of the Legislative Council policy that was modified today with regard to masks, I am not going to require masks as a general policy in the committee, and it'll follow Leg Council policy. I do want to note, however, if there is a person on the committee or if there's a person that we know that is coming before us that is immunocompromised or for their own individual reason would like to have us wear masks, then out of respect for that individual's request, if the chair is notified, I will ask everyone for that meeting to wear masks, and that is out of respect for those that may be appearing before us. And recognizing that we have different perspectives on masks, I also want to make the Capitol as open as possible and make that the priority. So if the chair is notified, I may on occasion say, everybody put a mask on, and I expect everyone to be willing to do so. Our first order of business today is confirmations hearing. Speakers referred the following governor's appointment to the Judiciary Committee for the Violent Crimes Compensation Board. Members have received a resume and cover letter for the appointee. The appointee is online and prepared to testify. And so for that purpose, we're going to open public testimony. And online is Greg Bringhurst, the appointee to the Violent Crimes Compensation Board. Mr. Bringhurst, if you would go ahead, state your name for the record, and you can proceed with your testimony. But before you get to do that, I get to note that Representative Vance joined us about 10 seconds ago. It sounds like about 1:37. Mr. Bringhurst.
Yes, thank you, Chair. My name is Gregory Bringhurst. Today I am in Fairbanks.
Go ahead and tell us a little bit about your experience and why you want to be on the Violent Crimes Compensation Board, and if you are currently serving, you could tell us how long you've served and your perspective about why you want to continue or what you've learned from the experience, or pretty much certainly anything else you want to tell us.
Thank you, Chair. Well, thank you, Chair Klayman, for having me in committee again. Thank you to the committee members for your service on this important committee and, of course, in the Alaska Legislature. As I said, my name is Greg Bringhurst, born and raised up here in Fairbanks. I live here now with my wife and two young daughters, 5 and 4 years old. Today, so I am asking your support to continue my service on the Violent Crimes Compensation Board. I was appointed as the public member in May of 2019. As we all know, far too many Alaskans have been victims of violent crime. It's been my honor to serve on this board for the last few years. I continue to learn all the time. I think we provide a very valuable service that I feel very, very fortunate to be a part of, helping people in their greatest time of need. I myself was a recipient of violent crimes compensation when I was 14 years old. My mother was murdered here in the Fairbanks area. And as you can imagine, at that time, as a 14-year-old, it was, I mean, as any age, it would be very traumatic, but it was very traumatic on me and influenced my life and the lives of others in a number of ways. I ultimately received some compensation through this very board. Details are a little hazy due to my age, but ultimately it helped me go to college. I don't know if I would have attended college as easily had it not been from a compensation that I received through this board. Since then, I've always, you know, thought if the chance was there, I would love to serve on the board. And I guess when you put things out in the universe, sometimes they do come true, and I've been very honored to do so. It did take me several years to start understanding that I wanted to use my experiences to give back. And one of the ways I've been able to do that is through public policy and public service. I am currently the regional director for the Fairbanks area for Senator Dan Sullivan. I am also serving the senator in a rural advisor role. Prior to that, I worked in Washington, D.C. with Senator Murkowski as a rural advisor and had a large portfolio there. And I feel pretty fortunate as well to have been able to give back and to serve in those roles and to continue to do so. I've spent a fair amount of time advocating in the halls of Juneau, and I think the policy aspect of my career and then my history of being a survivor, will help me to continue serving on this board. As always, we have a great, mighty, but small team of staff that work with us on the board. We always strive to do better in terms of processing claims timely, and we're making a lot of improvements over the last few years and also getting payments out on time. And I think, as always, in everything in life, we continue to strive to do better. I think I will leave it at that. I know you have a lot of committee business to take care of, but I do certainly appreciate you and appreciate your time listening to me, and appreciate your support. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Any questions? I would note that actually Mr. Bringhurst was before us last year, April 16, 2021, but questions for Mr. Bringhurst. Representative Eastman, we're on our usual one-minute limit for questions, but you can answer for longer than a minute.
Thank you. And if you were to be reappointed to this board or confirmed, what number of members would this board have currently?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, there's three members. So myself as the public member, we have an attorney member, and a healthcare professional member.
Follow up. Representative Eastman.
And the attorney member, the healthcare professional member, are those typically filled or currently filled by victims of crime like yourself?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, there's a mix of different types of people who serve. I, off the top of my head, I can't speak for whether or not the current members are victims. However, I can speak that they are very good at what they do in terms of their career. The doctor that we have on the board right now is very involved and very has been around a lot of situations through his professional career that are helpful to the board. But as to their whether or not they're survivors of a crime or victims in their lives, off the top of my head, I can't speak to that right now.
Okay, Paul?
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. And since you've had the opportunity to serve on this board in the past, and we don't get a chance to have you here before us very often, are there any thoughts that you can share with us on things that we might be doing better in the legislature on this issue?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman,
I just know, Mr. Bringhurst, really the only issue before us now is your confirmation.
Okay, sure. I'm happy to follow up with your office, Representative Eastman, and give you my thoughts on that for sure. Thank you.
I don't see any other questions, and I don't have anyone else online. Anyone else in the room that wants to provide testimony about Mr. Bringhurst? Hearing and seeing no one, I'm going to close public testimony. And I think we've all had our chance for questions. Any comments on Mr. Bringhurst? Representative Eastman, was that your hand?
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead, please proceed. Actually, I lost track. Starting with Representative Christ Tompkins, any comments on Mr. Bringhurst?
None on my end.
Representative Snyder?
No.
Representative Drummond?
Just want to say I'm sorry he had the experience that he did, but it appears to have brought him a great deal of wisdom in regard to this issue. So thank you, Mr. Bringhurst, for putting yourself forward.
Representative Vance.
Thank you very much.
Sorry to speak over you. Representative Vance.
I echo the comments by Representative Drummond that says thank you for turning your experience into service for others. We know that I can still hear a lot of the pain in your voice, and just want to thank you for utilizing that to help others, and believe that you can add that value back into this very rough process. So thank you for your service.
Thank you, Representative Vance. I appreciate those comments.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. And since there is only one public member on this particular board, and we probably ought not to expect to have them come before us, but once every 3 years, unless the term changes, you know, it strikes me that it would be very helpful to the committee, both in understanding the perspective of the applicant and also understanding, you know, what insights this board might have for us as a committee, that we would be able to ask questions based on the applicant's perspective. Seems unnecessarily curt that we would not be able to gain value from those that are coming before us.
Thank you, Representative Kirka.
No comments.
And I don't have any comments other than to also thank Mr. Bringhurst for his participation and willingness not only to volunteer, but to continue to volunteer and for a very important role in our state government. Having completed comments, Representative Snyder.
Yes, the Judiciary Committee has reviewed the qualifications of the governor's appointee and recommends that the following name be forwarded to a joint session for consideration. Gregory Bringhurst to the Violent Crimes Compensation Board. This does not reflect intent by any of the members to vote for or against this individual during any further sessions for the purposes of confirmation.
The name will be forwarded to the joint session. Please be sure to sign the paperwork as we continue on with our next order of business. And again, thank you, Mr. Bringhurst, for joining us today. Our second and final order of business today is House Bill 172, Mental Health Facilities and Medications, sponsored by the House Rules Committee by request of the governor. This is the fourth hearing of the bill in the House Judiciary Committee. At this time, we will take up amendments to House Bill 172. I'd like to put on record that legislative legal has permission to make any technical and conforming changes to the bill. Our office received four amendments to House Bill 172. As a reminder, the amendment process will be treated like floor amendments. Maker of the amendment moves the amendment and speaks to it with a three-minute time limit. Then we'll take questions, and questions will be limited to 1 minute per question. And we will proceed to discussion with each member limited to 3 minutes. Finally, the maker of the amendment will have 1 minute to wrap up. When we come to an amendment, the mover can either move the amendment or it will be withdrawn. We will not roll amendments to the back. And today we will begin with amendment number one. And as I'm the sponsor of the first two of these amendments, I'll hand the gavel over to my vice chair for the first two amendments.
Representative Klayman, when you're ready.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move amendment number one.
Object for discussion.
Representative Klayman, can you explain what amendment number one does?
So amendment number one is a cleanup in a couple of areas, and then I add some clarification in the other areas. The first one on page four, line 23 and 24, it was a drafting error to include the language or crisis residential center, psychotropic medication, rights and notification. Section 47.3707 only relates to admission to and hold at a crisis stabilization center. So the language that's getting deleted appears at subsequent sections in the bill. And on page six, lines three and line four, again, there was a drafting error. The way that notifications language was intended to read was that the court shall notify the respondent the respondent's attorney, the respondent's guardian, if any, the petitioner's attorney, if any, and the attorney general. And the corrections on page 6, line 3 and 4 have the effect of having the language read as it was intended to read about notification. And then the last four changes that appear on line 6 and line 7, both those appear in the places where there's reference to a detention at a crisis residential center, and the clarifying language that in all those instances reads 7-day detention at a crisis residential center, and that appears in four places. Those are all to make it clear in the statute that the hearing for detention at the crisis residential center is limited to a 7-day detention. And that 7-day detention was requested by the court system to both clarify matters and make it track the same language for the 30-day commitment. So that's the purpose of the changes in amendment number one.
Do we have any questions regarding the amendment? I'm seeing no questions.
See if the objection is maintained.
Excuse me. Do you maintain your objection?
I will withdraw the objection.
Thank you.
Where does that leave me?
You want to take a brief?
Well, here. Brief at ease. Tell me what I need. Back on the record. Seeing no objection, amendment number one is approved. Representative Clayman.
Move amendment number two.
I'll object for discussion.
And
Proceed, Representative Clayman. Can you explain amendment number two?
Amendment number two, these were technical changes brought to our attention by the department. The reference that had originally been made to 47.30.915 was actually not the place where we wanted the reference and the definition of the crisis stabilization and crisis residential centers to be placed, and that it needed to be as subdefinitions. And so the effect of amendment number two is to line up the definition of crisis residential center and crisis stabilization center within the definition of subacute treatment center, all appearing in 47.32.900, which is the place that the department had requested that. And if you want me to walk through the pages in more detail, I can, but these are technical corrections requested by the department.
Do we have any questions on this amendment? Is the objection maintained?
I will withdraw the objection.
Thank you. Seeing no further objection, amendment number two is adopted. I will now pass the gavel back to the chair.
Thank you, Representative Snyder. That brings us to amendment number three, Representative Kirkin.
I move amendment number three.
And I'll object for purposes of discussion. Representative Kirk, can you explain amendment number three?
Yeah, so basically there's still a lingering concern about due process and making sure that there's not the opportunity for abuse. And the thought was given to me to add an inspection from the Department of Health and Social Services. We're adding basically a twice annual on-site inspection at each treatment facility.
And I'd ask, does the department have any position with respect to amendment number three? And I see we both have Heather Carpenter here, and Steve Williams is also here from the Mental Health Trust. Ms. Carpenter.
For the record, Heather Carpenter, Health and Social Services. Through the chair, Representative Kirka, I will say that the department on the surface would be opposed to the amendment, not because we don't believe in licensing and inspecting these facilities, but because it would be duplicative of the work our healthcare facility licensing team is already doing. They already are on the ground through that requirement of hospitals and designated treatment facilities to license, to survey, you know, if there's something that's called an immediate jeopardy where there's an immediate concern of life or limb, then that team immediately goes into a facility like API or our other DET facilities to investigate quickly and respond. They would also, if this were to be added, it would be additional fiscal costs for the department because we would have to expand our current healthcare facility licensing team and hire more positions. Currently, all of those PCNs are nurses, which you can imagine are very difficult to recruit and retain right now because of the shortage nationwide. And those are nurses because it really requires that expertise with going in and, you know, surveying a healthcare facility, knowing what to look for all of these items. You know, and if there are more specific questions, I have my deputy commissioner on as well who can answer this, but we do believe that it is duplicative of the work the department is already doing.
Question, Representative Kirkin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To the chair. So if what I'm hearing you're saying is that, just to clarify, that each of these facilities that we're talking about in this bill, that the department already does inspections.
Through the chair, Representative Kirka, your amendment speaks just to designated treatment facilities. There are four of those in the state, which would be the Alaska Psychiatric Institute, Fairbanks Memorial Hospital, Mat-Su Regional Medical Center, and Bartlett Regional Medical Center. And yes, the department does regular inspections through our healthcare facility licensing that goes in and licenses and surveys all hospitals already.
Follow-up question?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair, so if this is the part that I had a little bit of trouble understanding. So if you're saying this is a duplicate, you're already doing it, then why would there be added cost if you're already doing these inspections?
Through the chair, Representative Kirka, it would be added cost because it wouldn't align with the requirements we already have to do these. So currently, some of the licensing and the surveys that we do are actually on behalf of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. So those are prescriptive, as well as the Joint Commission. So between those oversight agencies, they tell us when we have to go in, as well as the state law, which requires, you know, on-site inspections every so often. So this would be new rules, per se, and we are unclear on exactly what those would be and how they would differ. So on the surface, without knowing how different and they wouldn't align with our current requirements, we suspect it would require additional people since it would require that twice biannual that would be, you know, outside of our current schedule.
Follow-up?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair, so what would you say would be the frequency now on average for these facilities that you would have somebody from the state in there and able to inspect?
Through the chair, Representative Kirka, it's going to depend on the hospital. I would say of those four DETs, API is likely surveyed the most. And that, you know, is because if they're deemed or not deemed status, and deemed means how they're accredited. And I will tell you that I got a quick crash course with my healthcare facility licensing team, but I am by no means the expert on this. So if I can't answer a question, I will certainly say that. But, you know, if they're a deemed facility, they're allowed to operate under the accrediting body. Most of the hospitals are. API doesn't fall into that. So that's why anytime there's a complaint from a patient or, say, a provider at API sees something funky, they can put an anonymous complaint into our healthcare facility licensing team. If the team has to show some sort of response and documentation, and if it's an immediate jeopardy that I mentioned, you know, that immediate concern to life or limb, they are in there, non-announced, and quickly surveying those facilities.
Follow-up?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So that was a good answer, but I didn't hear a number. And if you don't have the number, and then you need to get back to me, I understand. And I can wait for that. So you mentioned there's some Medicaid requirements. What are those requirements for inspection?
So through the chair, Representative Kirka, I will say that state law requires a survey every 2 years for everyone that is deemed or non-deemed regardless. That's where the accrediting bodies come in and that timing. Like, it may not be our healthcare facility licensing team. It could be an accrediting body. So I can follow up in writing with the different options and kind of some examples of how frequently people are surveyed.
Then, Mr. Chairman, I will remove my amendment and because this is going to go to Hess next, and we'll look maybe for those answers.
So amendment number 3 is withdrawn. That brings us next to amendment number 4, Representative Kirker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move amendment number 4.
And I'll object for purposes of discussion. Representative Kirker, tell us about amendment number 4.
All right. So similar concerns that were raised in that we talked about in amendment number 3, and that is, maybe I'm not approaching this the right way, but I'm looking for additional safeguards, if you will. So here we're asking for the department to require there to be a grievance procedure that's consistent across the board, and for the department to get a copy of the procedure that the facility is using. And then also we're requiring them to have an appeal process.
And Ms. Carpenter, what's the department's position on amendment number 4?
Chair Klayman, if you'll give me a little bit of latitude, I just want to kind of share that the department takes the grievances in general incredibly serious, and we are committed to improving that process, continuing conversation with both patient advocates, stakeholders, and providers. But any quick change to grievance procedures really needs to be well thought out, because anything could cause administrative burdens. So the department is concerned that this amendment could cause added disruptions to our providers. And that is because grievance procedures are an existing requirement for national accreditation. And these facilities, and these, including these new facilities, do have to be accredited. And that's a requirement by our Division of Behavioral Health since 2015. And because there are multiple accrediting bodies, I mentioned a few of them, requiring a uniform grievance procedure for all facilities, you know, risks it not aligning, you know, so it might not align with the particular accrediting body that facility uses. And we are concerned that private providers could see this as an additional administrative burden and duplicative of the current accreditation requirements. And those accreditation requirements are very high standard. It's not easy for a provider to jump through those hoops to, you know, get that recognition. So, like I said, the department is incredibly committed to continuing this conversation. It is something that has come up as we've pursued this bill and talked with groups over the interim with the trust. We know there is space to have that conversation, but we're concerned about making any quick rush changes. Would not be wise in the long run, and we'd like to have time to have a very thoughtful and methodical conversation around that.
I have a question, but I believe Representative Eastman raised his hand first.
Well, you actually had the floor, so you can finish with your follow-up.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, through the chair. So in this amendment, we're not getting very detailed. We're not stipulating details about how they do the appeals or what the appeals or the procedure looks like. We're just requiring that they have them. So I don't see how this would be a conflict with whatever process they already have. If it's a good process. And if you're telling me they don't already have something like this, then I guess I see that as a problem.
Through the chair, Representative Kirka, it's in particular, you know, this, we already do require all of these facilities to have grievance procedures. That's generally a strong requirement of, you know, to go through any accrediting procedure. Plus, this is existing statute that they are required to have a formal grievance procedure. It's the addition of those words uniform that causes the greatest heartburn. And if they're are more, you know, drill down, I will phone a friend in Deputy Commissioner Wall, because I think he could expand on this concern as well.
I would love to hear that.
Deputy Commissioner Wall, you've been following the discussion. If you can add your perspective about the grievance procedure amendment.
Absolutely, Chair. Can you hear me?
Loud and clear.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Albert Wall. I'm Deputy Commissioner of Medicaid and Healthcare Policy. I appreciate the question, Representative Kirka, through the chair. I'm going to take a step back from this just because I have been following this conversation and let you know that all DETs that we're talking about right now are hospitals. Hospitals are licensed and accredited nationally, and they follow national accreditation and national regulation. All of those regulations nationally stipulate a grievance policy, and they stipulate visitation to do quality assurance checks and responses to questions and problems that occur at the hospital. One of the reasons you're having difficulty getting a specific number of times that a hospital is visited is because it depends on how many times CMS or the state is called on various issues. There is not a set number of times that, for instance, API has a survey team on site. There's a little bit more of a complex process. I wish there was a really simple answer. There's not. All facilities that are licensed hospitals that are accredited receive numerous quality assurance checks and safety checks from numerous organizations on an annual basis. The state, the Department of Healthcare, our Division of Healthcare Services, and their healthcare facility licensing section is only one of those. CMS also does on-site surveys. Their Joint Commission also does on-site surveys. And OSHA and other organizations like that also do on-site surveys. And so, and Medicaid itself does an on-site survey. So that it is, each facility is replete with numerous overlapping checks on quality assurance and safety. The issue around grievance policy is driven by accreditation boards. It is specifically driven by accreditation boards as part of the accreditation process. And as Heather Carpenter mentioned, those are stipulated in regulations and the documentation around the accreditation body. Most hospitals are accredited by the Joint Commission. We have a very rigorous and specific set of grievance policy that, as Heather mentioned, we can certainly give you in writing. Part of my concern about this amendment is that the rest of the regulatory body over the top of hospitals is set in regulation, and those regulations change periodically. And they're extremely strenuous for hospitals to meet. There are many cases in which a survey team comes on site and finds a problem and tells them it must be corrected and gives them a timeline to do so. So my concern is that if we put a stipulation in statute and then the regulatory requirements of those hospitals change for either their Joint Commission or the federal law or CMS regulation, then the state of Alaska will be forced to be in a position where we have to go back and actually amend the law in order to let them properly practice. Whereas if we continue on the path that we are, where all things are set in regulation, those things can be amended at a level beneath making law about the numbers of times that hospitals have to be visited. So that's my response. I'm hoping it's sufficient. I would want to go back and clarify, if I may, Mr. Chair, one other comment that was made.
Go ahead, Deputy Commissioner Wall.
Thank you for entertaining me. I would just point out that API is an accredited agency. Occasionally during a survey, there will be a plan of correction on an issue in which that accreditation is jeopardized, but they are accredited through the Joint Commission.
Any further follow-up, Representative Kirka?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, a minute ago, to the chair, the concern was the term uniform. And so with all of these requirements, are there multiple, grievance forms and they're not uniform? And why are they not, why would they not be uniform if they're not uniform? If that's the concern, because that was the one, I'm hearing two concerns. One is that making that the grievance process is uniform would be undue burden on the facilities. And the other concern I'm hearing is that because there's other interests in regulating these from the feds and other institutions, that somehow this amendment could get in the way of that in the future. I'm still not very clear on why, because this is very broad and this is not very exacting, so to speak. So if we can, I guess, answer the first question about uniformity.
Sure. Let me take a stab at that. So through the chair, Representative Kirka, the issue with the word uniform is, in plain language, we are micromanaging providers to a level that we're not doing in other healthcare facilities. So or other healthcare instances. For instance, if you go to the doctor now for a physical health condition, you know, all those doctors have HIPAA privacy protections. They have grievance procedures. But we're not saying they all have to be exactly the same when you go to a doctor in the Valley versus a doctor in Juneau and so on. So that uniform piece, is telling, you know, all providers that it has to be word for word the exact same, the exact process, and we're not allowing for, you know, regional differences, how cultural differences, so on and so forth. And I think that's really important to remember in Alaska. I can guarantee they all do have grievance procedures as it is required here, and those would, you know, be very pertinent. And like I said, we can continue to improve those. But on the fly, that uniform word does give us a lot of heartburn without having the providers in the room to be able to talk on that and what that burden would be for them.
I would just make the observation in a somewhat statutory sense that in court, adding the word uniform carries more meaning than you might think.
Mr. Chair, may I, would you entertain me one more time?
Sure, briefly.
I apologize, I'm not in the room, so I have difficulty making eye contact. I would just point out that the Joint Commission requirements for a grievance policy are uniform. Every hospital that is Joint Commission accredited must follow that uniform set of grievance policy. And there are more stipulations that an individual hospital may put upon themselves above and beyond that standard, but the standard is uniform. And again, we will provide that reference to you so you can see what the standard is. And we could certainly ask one of our partners or provide you with APIs, grievance policy, so that you could see what's perhaps in addition at some facilities. Some facilities that are larger, larger companies like Providence, you know, they're very large. They may have a very well-developed set of grievance policy that's way above and beyond what the accreditation requires. But the standard at the Joint Commission is a uniform policy for every accredited hospital.
Any other questions, Representative Kirka?
Mr. Chairman, a minute ago you said that the term uniform being added you think would provide more consequence than I realize. Can you elaborate?
Consequence, I'm not sure is the word I would use. I just think that, I mean, like there's this whole body of law that comes from the Commission on Uniform Laws. And so you have a uniform Notary Act, uniform. There's just hundreds of proposed uniform acts that gets proposed by the Uniform Law Commission. And so when this is just one small slice of uniformity, when you use that word as a term of art in statute, it tends to bring a requirement of conformity that is different than just saying you're going to have a grievance procedure in place that meets certain requirements. If you're requiring uniformity, then Facility A's procedure must be the same as Facility B's, whereas if you're supposed to have grievance procedures but they're not uniform, then one could look and say, well, do these check all the boxes of what needs to be in a grievance procedure to meet due process requirements for grievances, but they don't have to be identical word for word, and the uniform tends to bring in greater demand for consistency word by word versus issues that are addressed effectively. If you want to ponder that, we'll let Representative Eastman have his turn at a question or two. And Representative Vance wants in the queue as well. Representative Eastman.
Thank you. And my concern is that we don't have a situation where we're at a facility and patient in room A has one process that they file their grievance, and patient room B is given another process where they file whether it's these types of grievances or whether it's a sexual harassment claim or whatever it is, generally the expectation, I think, should be that it's uniform and that you don't treat one patient differently and make them go through an extra hoop or two hoops to get to where they need to go. Does the department have any opposition to requiring that within each facility that their grievance process be uniform?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, this is Heather Carpenter for the record. I think it's fair to say that we would absolutely presume that their grievance procedures in the same facility, especially for the same services, are the same. A provider, you know, would, and I would say, as I mentioned, all of these providers have to be accredited. An accrediting body would not allow a grievance procedure to be different from patient to patient when they're being served in the same facility. So, you know, it would be the same if I walked in, or I'm going to pick on, you know, Steve Williams sitting in the back, and we're served by the same agency sitting next to each other, and we both had a grievance, it would move through that appeal process the exact same way.
Yeah, Paul.
Representative Eastman.
Thanks. I think it might be helpful to contact the drafter then and see if your concern about uniformity between facilities isn't just maybe unneeded based on the way the amendment's been drafted. I mean, if I was drafting the amendments and I was wanting it to be uniform within a facility, I think I would write it very similar, if not exactly the same as is written here. So if we need to contact a drafter, to assuage those concerns, I certainly don't object to doing that.
Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I don't think that required a response.
Well, is there a drafter available?
We don't have a drafter on the phone. No. Nope.
I do have a follow-up then.
Nope.
Through the chair. Now, going back to the second part of the amendment on lines 10 and 11, does the department not currently request a copy of the grievance procedures? Because if they don't, and I know you mentioned earlier the department's very concerned about grievance procedures, but if they don't actually collect that copy at some point, it seems like they're so concerned, but they don't actually want a copy of it. Can you help me understand what's going on there?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, I think I'm going to phone a friend on this one. I will say it gets a little bit different because of how we're expanding the definition of an evaluation facility, so I want to try to give you an answer that's, as correct as possible. But in terms of how it exists right now, before prior, expansion of the term for evaluation facilities, when we go into a hospital, which all of these facilities are right now, those are things that they're going to look at. They're also going to have to turn that into the accrediting body who's going to look at their grievance procedure. So all of those at some point are reviewed by the department. I wouldn't say we have, copies on hand of all of them, but if I can phone a friend to Director Moreau Johnson on how the division handles this, that might give you the best answer.
We'll think of it as a lifeline.
Yeah.
But we don't think you're in crisis. Ms. Moreau Johnson.
Hi, everybody. Thank you. For the record, my name is Jennifer Moreau. I'm the director of the Division of Behavioral Health. And we can provide you a more full-fledged answer in writing, but the basic answer is to streamline administrative burden. We hear continually from our providers about the administrative burden associated with becoming behavioral health providers, and we are very eager to streamline in any case that we can. And through the accreditation process, that is our ability to streamline, allowing the accrediting body to do that collection.
Thank you.
Representative Vance.
Thank you. Through the chair, Ms. Carpenter, we've talked about the grievance process, but the other piece of the amendment on line 8 is the appeal procedure. What does the patients have as far as an appeal process?
Through the chair, Representative Vance, any typical grievance procedure policy absolutely has to require an appeal process. And that would be something the accrediting bodies, when they're going through and asking, the individual providers to be accredited, and they're giving their grievance procedure, it's going to have those appeal rights in through that. So I would say that's, inherently implied in the current language that exists in statute. And to have a true grievance procedure, you have to be able to appeal up when your first, inquiry into it is not met.
Follow up?
Representative Vance.
So when we're talking about the evaluation facilities and the designated treatment facilities, right now we have 4. But am I correct that the intent of this legislation is to have more in the future to be able to meet the needs of Alaskans?
Through the chair, Representative Vance, correct.
So, Mr. Chairman, if you allow me a little bit of conversation here, as I...
Please proceed.
As I recall, before I became a member of this body, the legislature passed a law that required hospitals to provide, to be transparent in having a listing of how much they charge for basic services. Am I correct in that?
There definitely was a bill about posting a schedule of some fees, but which fees gets kind of complicated, and it was a limited list. And I don't even want to begin to say what was on the limit, but if we're talking about the same legislation, it was somewhere between, I was saying, 15 and 25 prices were supposed to be available or listed or posted by medical providers.
I'm not going to ask for that list right now, but just searching for the...
I would fail the test, guaranteed.
I'm searching for the intent behind it was, if I have it correctly, was from the patient's perspective to be able to have a uniformity, if I will, that when they walk into a hospital, they know that that list is going to be present for their, so that they can make a better decision. And that's kind of how I'm seeing this amendment, is that what the maker of this amendment is asking is that when a patient is going into any evaluation facility or treatment facility, that they know what an appeal process could possibly look like. And if we need to change the word from uniform to something that has a little bit looser term, but provides a basic framework of consistency so that the patient's perspective for whatever treatment facility they're going to be in, they know they can have that sense of security that it's going to be a similar grievance and appeal process so that it builds that trust. Because what we've seen in the past couple of years, well, and beyond that, especially with the issues of API, is that there's been an incredible breakdown of that trust. And by knowing that they are going to have this the sense of uniformity, of due process, that they don't have to have the fear that it's going to be overcomplicated. Because I think a lot of people don't speak up and say that they have a grievance because of the feeling that it's going to be too difficult. So I'm hoping that we might be able to come to either find a way to amend this or have an understanding that this is not overburdensome. I struggle with the fact that we keep falling back on saying, well, there's national standards, as if the national standard is the gold standard. We need to be able to say as a state that we have a standard, that we are going to have a consistency in this process for Alaskans, regardless of what the national standard is. It may be the gold standard, but I don't want us to be absent in what we are saying as the legislature on what that could look like. And I do not by any means want to put more burden, but I would encourage the department to not fall back on rejecting this simply because of administrative burden. That is a very it makes it feel like you're more concerned with the providers than the patient. And I know that that's not your heart, but that's what I've heard in the responses today. And I would like us to be able to have some conversation on what this could look like if it's needed. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And I think that was more of a perspective and not a question. If I missed the question, let me know.
What word could we use instead of uniform that would provide the intent of consistency across facilities that doesn't tie them into having to have every single word uniform?
And I would just make an observation, and then I'll invite a response either from the department or actually Mr. Williams wants to provide a response. The topic of whether this is an observation, the topic of whether the existing grievance procedures that we have, which are very much in place and are being utilized by patients, and those are different than that list of prices that we passed legislation about, because that's when you walk in and you say, this is what you might pay. as to psychiatric facilities, we're talking about people who many times are not, they're having difficulty in functioning. And the reason we have involuntary commitments and their appointed lawyers is to make sure they do know their rights, so that even if you had their rights posted at the door, the sense they would understand their rights or be able to advocate for their rights in a very complicated legal environment is all the reasons why they get appointed lawyers to represent them and help them through that process. But as to the grievance procedures themselves, those are in place today. Are they perfect? I can't speak for the department. I would say almost every grievance procedure could be fine-tuned and made better. But the challenge I think we face now is, are the grievance procedures we have today so broken that people aren't able to air their grievances? And if they're not broken, the goal of this bill is to actually get services in place for people in crisis to treat them more effectively. And I think the notion, should we be looking at the grievance process in more detail, that may very well be appropriate, but I think it's way beyond the scope of this bill to try to figure that out in an amendment process in committee. I invite a response, because I'm just making Matt Clayman chair type responses. Ms. Carpenter, do you want to add anything?
Thank you, Chair Clayman. And for the record, Heather Carpenter, DHSS. I think you said that really well, Chair Clayman. And, Representative Vance, we take it very seriously at the department to balance, the rights of individuals and their concerns and their grievances, as well as making sure we're not adding undue burden to our providers who we count on to stand up and do these services. The Alaska Psychiatric Institute is one institute that is run by the state. Everything else is dependent on our community partners, and that's just how our behavioral health system is set up and how our physical health system is set up. We need those to be able to stand up and do this. And we're not trying to be flippant. Like, we absolutely take grievance procedures incredibly seriously, and we know there are some people who we need to hear from, the chairman said, that would love to go way beyond the scope of this. But that's going to take a lot of time, because we also need those patients, the individuals with lived experience. We need the public defenders. We need the providers who are doing this all in the same room to have that conversation with us. And I know it is something that the trust and the department have talked about. How do we make space for that conversation? How do we have it thoughtfully, not make, a quick policy decision by amendment, but really thoughtfully bring everybody together to see how we might improve this system overall. But again, right now I would say our underlining requirements in the involuntary commitment statutes do protect this grievance procedure. You heard both myself and Mr. Bookman in previous hearings talk about how patients have to be made known of their rights. That still stands in these new facilities. They have to be given a notification of their rights, which includes the right to a lawyer, grievance procedures and all of that. But again, we need to balance, how do we make sure if somebody is in crisis, how they understand that? And if, it means after the fact, when they leave that facility, and which I assume is when most of these grievances may happen, and they're stabilized, how they can then, get that grievance procedure addressed. The other player in this space that I think we can't forget is a resource is the ombudsman. The ombudsman is, continuously working with the department to recognize areas we can improve. They have the immediate oversight to go in and investigate API, and that's where we have the most back and forth with them. But they would be a great voice, that the department and the trust would likely bring into that conversation, too, when we're looking broader.
Thank you, Ms. Carpenter.
Representative Snyder. And Representative Kierke, you're next after Representative Snyder.
Mr. Chairman, so I understand where we are in the process. Are we still doing questions, or have we moved into discussion? I've lost track.
Well.
Mine is more of a discussion component.
You asked a question after a pretty long soliloquy. It isn't entirely clear, but I'll give you a chance to say what's on your mind. Representative Kierke is next in the queue, but go ahead and
Okay.
I'll give you the same leeway I gave Representative Vance and probably even give you as much time. Relax on time. I wasn't watching the clock.
I'll do my very best to move at a good clip. But your comments earlier, Mr. Chairman, were ones that I was scribbling down as well. I think three quick points. I think the issues that we're seeing at API, for example, which are serious and significant, and I think rightfully we're concerned, but I'm not convinced, or I have not necessarily heard evidence that it's due to the grievance procedure. I would want to spend more time looking at what has ultimately led to these grievances, and in some instances, it may be because we have folks who are partially overburdened or underfunded, and I would want to direct my attention to what is leading to those grievances in the first place. But I also think amendments like these, I think, are coming from a good place and a good direction and are important. But because the implications of these types of amendments can be so far-reaching and have such broad implications for the patients, the providers, our administrators, I think it's very important that they're done thoughtfully and, when at all possible, done in collaboration with the department itself. And we try to take that approach to go back and forth to craft something and make sure that the amendments that we're offering are coming from a pre-existing basis and knowledge of how things are currently working and then build an amendment from there. And I think we need maybe a little bit more of that with this kind of with the amendment that's before us today with amendment number 4. And last, I'll wrap up. I think this bill is really focused on making sure we have proper care and treatment opportunities and facilities. And there's a feeling of urgency behind that, and rightfully so. And I would prefer that we focus on that for this bill. And I think we've raised some very good issues that can be addressed in a separate piece of legislation that separately can each move faster. And that's what I would advocate for. Thank you for that latitude.
Representative Kirkham, you can either ask questions, or since you're the maker of the amendment, you may also just merge into your windup.
Right. So I guess firstly, for my question, in this bill, we're being asked to expand substantially the scope of what we're doing in the state with these facilities, and as Representative Vance mentioned, more facilities. So I think it's most definitely appropriate to, when we're doing that, look at, okay, or do we have enough safeguards in place? Are we doing this appropriately? And so to the, it seemed like the main objection, the concern from the department over the word uniform, and I'm just looking at the amendment again, and I guess I disagree with your interpretation of the amendment, because the way I read the amendment is that the facility is required to have a uniform formal agreements procedure. It's not saying the department's required to have it and that the facilities have to adopt it. It's saying that each facility has to have their own uniform formal grievance procedure, which I would hope would already be in place. And it sounds like you're saying they pretty much already do. And based upon everything I've heard today, I'm not actually hearing that this creates any additional burden, because it sounds like it's already in place. We're just now requiring it in statute. The only additional, I guess, requirement would be the department would keep a copy on hand. If you can respond to that.
Through the chair, Representative Kirka, I think, you know, our team respectfully disagrees with the interpretation of uniform, and we would take this as requiring uniform, you know, that all facilities, the grievance procedure has to be the same, and it's not just within a facility for each patient. So I think that piece is very unclear with how it is drafted.
Representative Kirka, and wrap up on this amendment.
Through the chair, I guess I'm reading an evaluation facility and a designated treatment facility shall have a uniform formal grievance and appeal process. So your interpretation is that all facilities would have the same exact uniform procedure.
Through the
would
chair,
be required by this amendment.
Through the chair, Representative Kirka, you are correct. And you will note our hesitation because this is a highly litigious area of statute as well. So, you know, we would expect a lot of we would have a lot of eyes on how the department is implementing that and, you know, oversight, whether that be through the court system, the ombudsman, et cetera, et cetera.
Mr. Chairman, so the intent of the amendment was to provide consistency with the...
No, I think you've made it clear. Yeah. I think you're not going to Yeah. You have a disagreement with the department, and but that's just part of the legislative life, Representative Kirk.
Right,
I wish I could
right.
I wish I could help you, but I don't think I can. This is kind of where we are, and this is an area that was admittedly outside the scope of the bill. So you're not only amending, but amending the title, and I'm certainly giving you the latitude to try to do that. But I think it's part of the framework in which it arises. But we're pretty much done with discussion, Representative Easton. I'm more looking for final comments. I think we kind of exhausted the question landscape. So
we're past the question phase. I believe I have a solution, though.
I don't know if you do, right. Go ahead.
Let me take a stab at it anyways. I think if we were to replace a uniform with an internal uniform, I think that would resolve the ambiguity. So I would like to move Conceptual Amendment 1, which would replace a uniform with the words an internally uniform.
So you want to insert the word internally.
Yes, and change A
to N and add the word internally. So we have Amendment Number 1 to Amendment Number 4 offered by Representative Eastman to add the word internally and a vowel or a minor word to add that to Amendment Number 4. Is there objection to Amendment Number 1 to Amendment Number 4? Hearing no objection. Now, as to Amendment 4 as amended, Ms. Carpenter, does that change the department's position in any way with respect to Amendment Number 4?
Chair Klayman, Heather Carpenter, DHSS, that addition makes it better. I would remain, and then I would welcome if Deputy Commissioner Wall wants to add that the department would prefer we do this in a very thoughtful way when we just look at grievance procedures and do this, like I mentioned, where we're doing a wholesale review of grievance procedures for all of these facilities, in depth with the trust, with patients, with patient advocates, with providers to ensure we're not making any rash change. That would not be good for any party involved.
And Deputy Commissioner Wall, I did see you on my attention, and I apologize for not seeing you earlier, but now you got another chance.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate your indulgence. And this is Deputy Commissioner Wall for the record. We had responded to a couple of questions that we were going to provide what the standard for grievance policy was, and just to speed things up, I went ahead and grabbed it. It is federal regulation 482.13 CFR. And I want to read you just a little bit of that, if you'll indulge me. The requirement is that a hospital must establish a process for prompt resolution of patient grievances and must inform each patient who has that there a way to file a grievance. The hospital's governing body must approve and be responsible for the effective operation of the grievance process and must review and resolve grievances unless it delegates the responsibility in writing to a grievance committee. The grievance process must include a mechanism for timely referral of patient concerns and regarding quality of care, premature discharge, and so forth. The hospital must establish a clearly explained procedure for the submission of a patient's written or verbal grievances to the hospital. These rights are given to the patient prior to becoming an inpatient at that hospital. The grievance process must specify timeframes to review for the grievance process and provision. There must be a patient advocate and so on and so forth. This is a well-developed federal policy and regulation. Here's my concern. It's twofold, and I'll say it one more time. One, this is a regulation. If we stipulate in a state statute that we must have above and beyond what the federal regulation does, the federal regulations change, our state statute will have to be amended. That's first point. Secondly, most of the actual on-site surveys are accomplished by a federal team or a joint commission team. They hold hospitals nationally and at the state level responsible for their behavior in and around grievance policies and safety and any other thing. When they come on site, they measure the hospital against the standards, and it was interesting to hear Representative Vance use the term gold standard because, in fact, that's exactly what it is. There's a little icon called the Gold Standard Award, and hospitals can get that through this process. And when they get it, they put it on their website, and they say, look, we have met the gold standard of this process. If we move towards a state directed state law that says they must have X, Y, and Z above and beyond what the federal one requires, when the federal team comes on site and does their study, they're going to look at the federal requirements to make sure that organization adheres to the federal requirements. They're not going to look at the state requirements because those aren't their requirements, which will in fact mean that the state will have to spin up an extra team, whatever the determination of this statute, this proposed statute is. The department will have to spin up an extra team, send them to that facility to check the above and beyond, which is now required by the state, which the federal government doesn't require. So there will be an added cost. What that cost will be, I'm not sure yet because we're talking on a fly here and I can't do the analysis, but I'm telling you that there likely will be one. And those are my two concerns. Again, it is CFR 482.13, patients' rights.
All right. So I don't hear any further discussion. I'm going to maintain my objection to amendment number four. Representative Eastman, is Representative Kirker's amendment?
Yeah. Now that we've passed the conceptual amendment, I just want to be able to offer my opinion on how I will vote on this amendment.
All right. We're going to briefly let folks, Representative Eastman, we got a minute on amendment number four as amended.
Yeah. I think hearing from the department, I keep hearing words like above and beyond, and I'm picturing in my mind, a pole vaulter and trying to make a 12-foot jump. I don't see that in this amendment. What I see is, and I've heard, is that most of this is already being done by the department already. We're being, in my mind, invited to abdicate our responsibility to the feds for this kind of oversight.
Mm-hmm.
I think the picture I see is more of a 3-inch jump. And that's just requiring that the state actually collect a copy of the grievance procedure, which doesn't even need to be in print. That can be in an email, saved on a share drive. So I support the amendment.
Thank you. Before I go to Representative Kirka, anyone else want to make comments as to amendment number four as amended? Hearing and seeing none, Representative Kirka in windup. You too get a minute.
Just that I'm entirely unpersuaded by the department at this point, and that I think these are very, very basic requirements that are not above and beyond.
Okay. Well, the objection is maintained. Madam Secretary, if you'd please call the roll. Amendment number four as amended.
Representative Drummond?
No.
Representative Snyder?
No.
Representative Price Tompkins?
No.
Representative Eastman?
Yes.
Representative Kirka?
Yes.
Representative Vance?
Yes.
Chair Clayman?
No.
3 yeas, 4 nays.
By a vote of 3-4, amendment number 4 has failed. And that is the last of our amendments. We're going to take a brief at ease. On record, that brings House Bill. Well, we have House Bill 172. We have addressed all the amendments that were submitted, and we are going to adjourn for the day and hold this bill for further review. Our next meeting is scheduled for Friday, February 25th at 1:30 p.m. We will stand adjourned. The time is now, looks like 2:44 p.m.